This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. It's Friday, the 18th of February, 6 in the morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mukhtar in studio today with Tan Chun Lee and Philip C.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm really looking forward to Monday.
Oh, wow. I love how you just skipped over the weekend and looking forward to the next working week. I can see that you're all in this rah-rah productiveness.
As they say, Friday is the grandfather for Monday.
Friday is the grandfather for Monday. Okay, oh great. Goodness. Great stuff.
I was going to say that today is Friday, the official, and no more Embryo Friday, or what else is there?
Well, don't encourage me, I would say.
Yes, today is Friday, the start of the weekend. Tell us what you've got planned for the weekend. Do you have any interesting activities lined up? And while you do that, we're bringing to you a range of issues and conversations this morning. There's a whole bunch of stuff we'll be discussing. Beginning at 7:15, we're going to be talking about cybersecurity scams, which have been on the rise. What kind of policy response is needed, and what can we do to protect ourselves? We'll be discussing this with Ho Siew Kai, Executive Director at Deloitte.
And you know, Charles, we were having a conversation yesterday about perceptions, right? How Southeast Asian citizens perceive all these global powers like China, United States. And so today at 7:30, we're going through the findings of a recent survey by the ICES Yusof Ishak Institute on foreign policy views in Southeast Asia with Senior Fellow Sharon Xia, as she joins us for insights.
And at 7:45, how has the pandemic affected education outcomes, particularly via online learning? Kulai MP and formerly Deputy Education Minister Teo Ni Ching gives us her views.
All right, we'll have all this and more today, Friday the 18th of February. You'll want to keep it here, BFM 89.9. The Rolling Stones with I Can't Get No Satisfaction. And just before that, it was the Beatles with Why Don't We Do It on the Road. You're listening to The Morning Run with Shazana Mukhtar, Tan Chun Lee and Philip C.
I love that song and I love Mick Jagger. I mean, can you imagine 78 years old and still prancing around the stage? Incredible energy, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But I have an issue with the lyrics though, because in the lyrics it says, when I'm driving in my car, when a man comes onto the radio, he's telling me more and more about some useless information supposed to fire imagination. I hope he's not referring to me.
Do you feel personally affronted
I
by that, Phil?
Very affronted when I was listening to the song just now.
There's a saying in Bahasa Malaysia about this: siapa yang makan cili dia terasa pedas.
Whatever.
And this song was originally chosen to be dedicated to you.
Why? Please, pray tell. Because you picked this article, isn't it, about satisfaction trap?
Yeah, because this article talks about satisfaction, which is a macronutrient of being happy. And I see you as a very happy person all the time. And then when I was reading this article, it reminds me of you.
Well, clearly I place a very good facade, because I think this issue of satisfaction is going to be a very tough topic to discuss. And we were just commenting earlier, like, this could be a very short conversation or very super long discussion, isn't it, Shaz? Because it's very hard to get a handle on what makes us satisfied or not.
Yeah, and the article is quite philosophical, I have to say. I have to agree, also, it's very long. Which the author actually say that, is satisfaction equals to getting what you want? Which is what most people would think, that if I get what I want, I will be satisfied and happy. But what he thinks instead is satisfaction, a little bit sciencey here, satisfaction equals to what you have divided by what you want. So what they're saying is, the smaller your want is, the bigger your satisfaction is.
I think that's an interesting take. And this definition of wanting is a dynamic thing, you know. That's the problem I have, which is I am where I am now and I have certain wants and needs. So let's say I work and strive towards that and achieving those wants and needs, right? So I reach that point. I'm not sure whether everybody gets satisfied then, because then the goalpost also changes later.
Correct.
As well. Your wants and needs also evolve in period and time, isn't it?
That's exactly the point of the article, actually, because what he's saying is human beings are programmed to not enjoy anything for a very long time. So you might set a certain goals, but when you reach that goal, you may not be satisfied anymore and you will have new things or new wants. So that's why they're saying the main important thing here is to manage that want.
But is it a bad thing to want? Mm. I guess that's a question that I had when I was reading this, because in a way, that's what has driven humanity, right? The fact that we progress is because we've wanted to achieve bigger and greater things. So in a way, it's biology that we are kind of engineered to want more things.
I agree with you, actually. So when I was reading this article, I was thinking, what are we going to do with the people who are ambitious? You know, like they want to strive for a lot of achievement in life.
Yeah.
Are you telling them not to be ambitious?
Well, we want people to strive. We want people to progress and move forward, right? And so I feel a balance of dissatisfaction is very important. And I think the human instinct is innately dissatisfied. But the question is balance. How much do you want to take in? And also sometimes be at peace with the circumstances you're in, right? It's striking that right balance in my view.
Yeah, that's right. And I also wonder, one of the questions that I have in mind is, so if you have a lot of, like you said, dissatisfaction, so then you will tend to want to reach complete those dissatisfaction or make them satisfied. So does that make you a competitive person? And is that a bad thing?
It's not a bad thing. Actually, my bigger issue is that if you're dissatisfied and you don't take action on it, that's a bigger problem.
I think that is the situation that many people may find themselves in, the fact that they are not happy with where they are, but they feel paralyzed to act. I think that is something that is experienced by many and maybe not given enough attention. Or you know, how do we get people out of that trap then?
I think it's hard. And you know, we call this getting into a funk. And many people throughout the pandemic especially did feel it, like they were not happy with the circumstances we are in. They were not satisfied. But because they were confined, or they felt they were confined at home, or they were literally physically, they just couldn't do anything. So I think then they just get stuck. And so I feel the worst scenario is being dissatisfied, not doing anything about it. There's also some concern about being dissatisfied and just continuously doing it, but that's a bigger problem in my view.
I think your question raised another thing for me, Chin Lee, whether dissatisfaction drives competition. I guess the whole idea that it has to be competitive, right? That's also something not great about this whole keeping up with the Joneses. The fact that your satisfaction depends on either beating someone or you know, doing better than something else. I think that is a recipe for unhappiness in life for the longer term. Mm. So that's, I guess, one of the toxic elements of why being dissatisfied is not that great.
Yeah, so dissatisfaction, right? What is the intention of the dissatisfaction? Is it because you are not, you know, in step with your peers? Or is it that you really want to be a better person, inward or internal? So understanding the motivation or the reason behind the dissatisfaction is also very important.
I think that is a perfect note to end the conversation on. Tell us what you think. Does dissatisfaction drive progress in your life? Or are you stuck in a satisfaction trap where you just keep going round and round on the treadmill? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We are referencing an article in The Atlantic. You can look it up. It's called The Satisfaction Trap by Arthur C. Brooks. We are taking a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss whether a degree qualification is really needed in the hiring process. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. 1979 by the Smashing Pumpkins. This is one of my favorite songs by them. And here's just a fun fact. Lead singer Smashing Pumpkins Billy Corgan wrote this because he was 12 years old when he was in 1979. And so he wrote it as a coming of age song.
Oh, wow.
12 years old, coming of age.
I love that.
Yes.
I think it's an iconic song, actually. When I was in university, I was like listening to it quite a bit. Loved that song.
Well, Friday, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Shazana with Philip and Chen Li. We are talking about education today. And education has long been seen as the great equalizer, with the hopes of a better future often pinned on obtaining a higher education degree. So the idea is you get a degree, you get a better paying job, and hence a more comfortable life. But what if a degree qualification isn't actually necessary for some jobs, and instead it only serves as a barrier to entry? So Chen Li, you have this story for us from the Harvard Business Review.
Have you heard of something called degree inflation?
Oh, yes.
Oh, first time for me. So apparently in the early 2000s, there's a lot of employers who wants to or add a degree requirement to most of the jobs. But those jobs doesn't really require a degree in the first place. So that makes me wonder, do we have a lot of jobs now that also do the same. Although in the article, it talks about more like middle skill jobs, like maybe electrician, dental hygienist, paralegal, police officers that you most of the time you may or may not need a degree for it. I don't know. But, you know, as an employer, as an employee's perspective, I'm very curious, you know, like Phil, you are an employer in a way. Is that a very important factor for you when you hire someone?
Well, no, I think what's important is you just look at a CV as an example and how we structure a CV. How does it look right? The first thing you see is qualification, then experience, and then usually at the end is your skill. You know, we have all been programmed to think that qualification starts, then experience, and then the skills come at the end. Like, oh, I can do my skills below. So actually, naturally, the CV reflects how many of us employees and employers think.
I guess the degree qualification is taken as a shorthand of what you can do, of what the standard of your capabilities are. So it's sort of like an easy reference for employers, an easy starting point. But the article that you're referencing talks about how for certain jobs where you don't really need a college degree per se, where you would probably get certification, or maybe it's based more on the job experience type of skills. The fact that they are asking for degrees means that it pushes out a certain segment of the population from these jobs who would ordinarily be able to get to them. Yeah.
And I also wonder, say, if it's a middle skill job, as is what the article has been saying, which you are you're sort of in between your high school education and a university degree, but maybe they require a degree for those sort of jobs, but would they pay higher if, you know, you have a degree?
Well, I think that might have been the case or the perception for many people. And I think Malaysia is afflicted with this problem. You see many people pursuing degrees, and they do very generic degrees like business administration or such. But actually what the country needs a lot more is TVET, right? Vocational kind of skills. But it's just a mismatch of what people want and what the industry and markets need. And that's the biggest challenge we have here. We don't need so many degree holders. You know, but I do think degrees reflect a bit about your skill and your experience, so you can't discount it entirely.
There was something about the article that I thought was interesting about how if you have a degree, it seems to indicate that you have a certain amount of soft skills. So that's kind of the impression or the assumption that employers make. If you have a degree, you should have these certain soft skills as compared to someone who doesn't have a degree. This could be a fallacy because, as we know, a lot of our graduates here often have the accusations that they don't have soft skills.
I think that's a very interesting point because it's a function of the degree. I know some degrees where there's no soft skill happening because there's no interaction, right? Whereas perhaps for me, I did an engineering degree where I had to do 25, 30 projects in a year. So that, of course, requires a huge amount of soft skill, so that's very helpful. But that I don't think you can say it for all degrees, but I always thought degrees at least help you build some depth, gives you some introduction to complexity of an issue, right? Perhaps that's also a reflection of why we do degrees as well.
There is also a discussion about, which is not captured in the article, about when should you have that degree? Should you, because a lot of us follow the path of after high school, you go for a university degree or maybe a master's degree after that. But is that pathway applicable for all? You know, what if after my high school education, I go for a vocational certificate and then I realize that, okay, this is something that I really want to do and then I go for a degree?
I think that's something that I found really interesting about the German vocational system, in the sense that for them, it's not a choice of whether you want to go vocational or you want to go for a degree qualification. You can go for vocational training first, and then later, if you want to go for a degree, it's very easy to convert your qualifications to a degree qualification, meaning that you can then pursue a higher a master's or PhD. And I think that level of flexibility, the way you can transfer your skills back and forth between the two tracks, that's an important factor in making vocational education more viable for a lot of people.
And I think you must continue pushing for adult learning, lifelong learning. That's core. regardless.
I agree with that, actually.
Well, tell us what you think. You know, are degrees overrated? Should more jobs be looking at specific skills rather than your paper qualifications? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio with your thoughts. We're heading into the 6:30 a.m. news bulletin now. It's 6:25. And when we come back with the global headlines. Taking you to the bulletin are the Indigo Girls with Closer to Fine, BFM 89.9. Islands in the Stream by Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Shazana with Phil and Chen Li. This is the time of the morning when we look at the global headlines. So tell me what has caught your eye.
Kamila Valieva. We were talking about her a few days ago, about the doping scandal that that was a debate about the medal and all that. And
let's give a little bit of context. So Kamila Valieva is the Russian figure skating athlete who has been found to have a positive sample
in her December, I think it was the Christmas, last year's Christmas Day sample.
So she was found to be, she had banned substances in her sample. And so there was the whole uproar about whether she should be allowed to continue competing in the Olympics or not. And she was allowed.
Yes. And then there was also the medal for the group, the team event that was being put on hold until today. It's still put on hold. So she was being allowed to compete in the individual event, which she did, but she came in at number four. She was actually one of the big favorites. Many people thought that she's going to win gold. But I think she's being affected by all this doping scandal and all the pressure that's on her. So instead, she didn't quite perform to her usual standards,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, so she's outside the medal table then.
Yeah, she's out of the medal table. But the good thing out of this is the medal ceremony can continue. You know, they can proceed to give out the medals for the individual event, but not the team event.
Well, I mean, I think it's appropriate that the council has to be hard when, you know, they find illegal substances in you, but my heart also still goes out to her. I think in this time and age, you know, so much media scrutiny can put a lot of pressure on athletes, you know, and comparing her, you can't really compare because Simone Biles also had the same issue as well, but she pulled herself out from the contention and did not compete, right?
Simone Biles being, of course, the American gymnast who
in the Summer Olympics.
That's right.
Yeah, so I think that's where it's a bit of a distinction here. But my heart really goes out to her. I mean, the immense and intense pressure on her to perform.
And she's only 15.
She cracked under pressure, yeah. At 15 years old, it's tough.
Yes. It's a tough story. And it's not over yet because they still need to determine what happens to her, whether her doping samples are validated or not. That remains to be seen. So moving away from the Olympics.
On a more, I think, interesting note, right? What is, I think, a very highly sought-after drop? Women train drivers in Saudi Arabia, because in the BBC it reported that 28,000 women applied for 30 train driver jobs in Saudi Arabia to channel people from Mecca to Medina. Right? Such a high demand.
Was that specifically were they seeking women for the position?
I think so. They were seeking women, apparently. So that's very interesting, right? But one thing to note is that Saudi Arabia has one of the world's lowest female workforce participation rates in the country. And, you know, since the past 1-2 years, we've seen an improvement, right, of women's rights in Saudi Arabia. So perhaps this is a sign of things to come.
Yeah, considering that they were only allowed to drive cars just a couple of years ago, now they're allowed to drive trains, which is fantastic.
I'm just curious, why driving train became a favorite amongst them? What about driving planes or, you know? I don't know.
There we go. Saudi Arabian women should, you know, be flying planes too.
I think actually, you know, it's so important that we need just women participation across all fields, regardless of any modes of transportation. Doesn't need to be trains, planes, it can be even ships going forward. But it's just very important. I think it also creates a very different environment on a positive light when we get a more balanced gender representation across the board.
Absolutely. And I will turn our attention now down to Australia, where news came yesterday that the biggest power plant the biggest coal power plant is actually closing 7 years earlier than planned because it says it's unable to compete with the influx of renewables. So this plant is now going to be closed in 2025 instead of 7 years later in 2030 something because they can't compete.
I think it's such an interesting story because if you recall, you know, during during COP26 in Glasgow, you know, Australia was very hesitant to make any commitments, right, on, you know, moving towards net zero. And what we are seeing here very clearly is that market is actually driving that decision and conversation, right? That actually coal fire is not economically feasible. That actually solar is and wind makes more sense. So in my mind, I'm wondering, especially in Malaysia, where 90% of our power generation is actually coal and gas, I wonder when that ticker will happen. When will we transition and realize that actually market forces show that renewable energies are feasible?
Absolutely. Australia, the government of Australia has come under fire because they've been very rah-rah for coal plants. Yeah, they've been a champion of the coal industry. Coal does supply 60% of the country's electricity, and they have been mum about how they're going to transition to renewable energy. I mean, everyone saw that their commitments to climate change were subsequently lower than other developed countries. Exactly. So there are concerns that given coal plants are shutting down sooner than expected, does the government have a plan in place to ensure that enough energy can be generated if these coal plants close?
Well, I think that's where, this whole issue of energy transition is becoming very politicized. You look at the United States, right, where all these marginal constituencies and states are purple states like Pennsylvania, they're coal country. And you look at Europe, where there's a whole issue about Ukraine. I'm sure this discussion about gas supply would have a conversation about renewable energy there as well.
Absolutely. All right. 6:45 in the morning, we are taking a quick break. And when we come back, we'll cover the top headlines in our local newspapers and portals, BFM 89.9. The Strokes with Hard to Explain. You're listening to The Morning Run with Shazana, Philip and Chen Li, where we try to explain the hard to explain issues. And right now we're looking through the local newspapers and portals for the top stories of the morning. Who'd like to start us off?
Well, I'd like to start with the Star, with the headline, A Difficult Deadline, because we know that we're just 12 days to the March 1st deadline when those who do not get their booster shots may lose their fully vaccinated status. This is a bit of a challenge because 2.8 million adults have not done so yet. And very interestingly, I think if you saw yesterday, Khairi Jamaluddin, our health minister, he had a press conference and he even did some mental calculations for us. And if we were vaccinating at the rate of 117,000 people a day, that would mean only about 1.7 million. So there would be a close to 1.1 million still not yet boosted.
So that's your PSA for this morning. Please sign up for your booster shot if you haven't yet. There was a slew of headlines related to COVID-19 and just announcements by the Health Minister, Khairi Jamaluddin. I think one of the headlines from Bloomberg actually says that we are going to be releasing we're going to be halting the release of standalone COVID-19 infection data. This was something we spoke about yesterday, Phil, about how the headline number of 27,000 new cases, for example, is not very helpful or doesn't give enough context when you take it away from indicators like hospitalization rate or the severity of the disease. So I think that's what the government is going to be doing moving forward. They want to reduce the fear factor about the rising case numbers. And instead, the number will be announced together with figures on hospital occupancy and usage of intensive care units in the morning every day.
That's right. I think yesterday they were trying to do that, right, with 107% increase, but with a 40% increase in ICU rates as well. Chun Li?
I want to talk about tourism again. It seems like I'm always thinking about tourism. it's already coming to the third year of our international borders being closed, and our Malaysian Associate of Tour and Travel Agents, Mata in short, President Datuk Tan Kok Liang, hopes that the government will reopen our borders soon. I want to also draw this to Thailand, because Thailand has opened their borders, and you can see that the Thai baht is emerging and really doing well. It's like an unlikely haven in our developing Asian market here. They were one of the worst performing currency in 2021, but they have now became one of the top ranking currency because of their quarantine-free visa program that has kick-started the tourism or travel industry for them a little bit. Mm. The currency actually climbed 3% versus the US dollar this year. So I hope that maybe, you know, this would help strengthen the points to the government to open our borders.
Well, I think the health minister will be announcing more renewed SOPs or updated SOPs regarding what to do with close contacts. For example, if your close contact has contracted COVID-19, I think they've also reduced the quarantine or isolation guidelines for healthcare workers that have tested positive but are asymptomatic. They'll still be allowed to go to work. So I think everyone's just parsing through what the best practices should be in light of how Omicron is affecting the country.
There is a bit of disagreement, though, on the tourism reopening strategy, opening states, because, you know, yesterday even Miti Minister Azmin Ali was saying that the cabinet was making a decision on that very soon. So there seems to be a lot of pressure within cabinet on different points of views about the reopening strategy. Whereas, as you said, you know, Chen Li, not only Thailand, but even Singapore, they've also streamlined their reopening strategy as well, beginning up to open more VTLs in the port. So I hope we come to a landing very soon on the tourism reopening, whether it's phased or not going forward.
It is an important decision because we do want to reopen borders, but we don't want to do it at the cost of challenging our resources if case infections rise beyond control. So
that's right.
I get it's a very difficult balance, and we do hope for policy clarity from the government as soon as they're able to provide it. Turning our attention to another area that probably needs policy clarity, and this is regarding our 5G rollout. So the Malay Mail carries this story. The envoys of the EU and a couple of other countries, the US and Japan, the High Commissioners of the UK and Australia, they've all written a letter to the government asking the government not to review the contract that has already been given to Ericsson for the 5G rollout. And this is related to the debate that's going on between whether we should have a single wholesale network or a dual wholesale network. And I think the uncertainty over this is just causing a lot of concern among foreign investors in terms of what's the policy going forward here.
I find that story interesting because it's parallel to another story in which our Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri Yaakob, said that Malaysia is said to have 3,500 sites, which is equivalent to 36% of coverage in populated areas by the end of the year. So I'm assuming that then the policy has not changed, because if he's willing to announce this clear rollout plan, so I'm wondering what is happening there and where is the alignment? Because he was doing this announcement in alignment with his plan of his national robotics roadmap.
Right. And you can't really have that target if certain if the implementation
and
is still kind of
stuck in. Crystallized yet.
Exactly. So we hope that this will be sorted out sooner rather than later, please. We'll be following the developments as they unfold. It is 6:56 in the morning. We're heading into the 7 a.m. news bulletin. And after that, we'll take a look at how global markets closed yesterday. Taking you to the news is The Jam with Absolute Beginners, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.